Welcome to the Ad Nauseam Podcast, where classical gourmands everywhere can finally get their fill. Join us for a delectable discussion of Greco-Roman civilization stretching from the Minoans and Mycenaeans through the Renaissance and right down to the present. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here are your hosts, Dr. David Noe and Dr. Jeff Winkle.
Welcome, Ad Nauseam listeners, to the 15th episode of our podcast. My name is David Noe. I'm here with Jeff Winkle, my co-host. How are you, Jeff?
Feeling really good today.
Excellent. Balmy here in the vomitorium, isn't
it? Yeah, it's an adequate level of balminess, I'd say.
Did someone tell you to put the balm on?
Nobody told me to put the balm on, but it's feeling good. It's feeling
good.
All
right. So we want to give a shout out as we start things out to Mr. Paul Wright.
Paul.
Paul's coming to us from Charlottesville, Virginia. Like everyone else who listens, he's a recent addition to the podcast.
Excellent, yes.
And we're very glad you're listening, Paul. Tell your friends, please. So today's topic, Jeff, is horror vacui.
Yes.
And the Dipylon vase. Horror vacui, fear of the empty.
Fear of the empty. Fear of empty spaces.
Right.
Yes.
And we're going to take a good close look at a very famous work of art that's in the museum in Athens.
Yes, this giant vase. Yep.
So, Jeff, why don't you start us out with your opening quote?
Right. So I chose this quote. And the more I thought about this quote, I think it's kind of a ridiculous quote. But I like it because I think it sets up what we're talking about today. So this comes from an article from the American Poetry Review by Nick Flynn and Beth Bachman. And they're talking about illuminated manuscripts in the Christian tradition. Nick is talking at this point, and he writes, "I like that punctuation as an extreme. I had pointed out that in early Christian texts, illuminated manuscripts, Bibles written out by hand, there was not only no punctuation, but also no space between the words, because of the fear called horror vacui, where Satan flies in and occupies any empty space, even the space between words. One monk, a radical, put a small mark on a page to slow down the reading, perhaps, and this eventually grew into what we call punctuation. So at that moment, a comma becomes an extreme act." So I don't know to what extent this is true. Nick here seems to be proposing some sort of origin story for punctuation, which sounds off to me.
Oh, definitely.
And this idea of Satan flying in between the words, I mean, I'm no expert on illuminated manuscripts, but that sounds a little sketchy to me.
Definitely. Right. I don't think that's the motivation behind the introduction of punctuation.
No, exactly right.
Satan flies in and occupies any empty space. Mm. First of all, Satan is an immaterial being, right?
Right.
So if he wanted to put himself in between the words, he wouldn't have any trouble doing so.
That's exactly right. So there's a lot of things off with this quote.
It is clever, though, and it's interesting.
Right. But Nick here mentions the horror vacui. Mm-hmm. So the lack of punctuation, words running together as an expression of that fear of the empty.
Correct.
And so we're going to be exploring that more in this episode.
So throughout this episode, what we want to offer to the listener is a wide-ranging tour, first of all, of some of the fears that pop up in the reading of literature and other areas of life. Mm-hmm. And then we want to offer them a really close look at one particular work of art, what I've already mentioned, called the Dipylon vase.
Right.
And the Dipylon vase is a late geometric vase. So this is about 750 BC, at the end of the geometric period.
Right around the same time as Homer and Hesiod, roughly.
That's right, little bit after them. We'll say more about that soon. And this late geometric vase is just packed to the brim with geometric designs. It has a horror vacui.
Horror vacui, right. So whoever painted this wanted to take advantage of every square inch.
Correct.
Yeah. All right. So before we get to this specific phobia fear, I thought it might be interesting to kind of go through some other kind of odd, at least on the surface of it, some odd fears that are out there. But David, do you have any phobias?
Oh, I have plenty of phobias, actually.
Would you be willing to maybe share a couple?
Well, let me think just a minute before I get too personal.
Okay.
I often have a fear of leaving projects unfinished.
Okay.
I don't know if there's a name for that. Home Depot phobia, perhaps.
I like that. I mean, does this spur you to actually finish things, or does it just multiply on itself?
No, it just spurs me to lie awake at night thinking about all of
all the stuff that
half-finished projects
undone
that litter my home. So I'm afraid of that. More seriously, usually before the first day of class, right, I have an anxiety dream like most people do, most teachers do. I've been teaching a very long time, as you have, 25 years.
Yeah.
I still get anxious before going into class.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
I don't know what it is. It's a desire to be loved, a desire to be feared, something like that.
Are you talking about the first day? I mean, with me, even having taught all these years, even before any class, before I walk in, there's always kind of that stage fright. Yeah, a little bit. That twinge.
You got to push. You got to push through it. Yeah, I do have that. I have a little bit of a fear of heights.
Yeah. Me too.
Not that I'm afraid to go up onto high spots, but I always think of, you know, what is the worst that can happen here? And it's hard. It's hard not to get those thoughts out of my mind. For example, climbing to the top of the cupola in St. Peter's Basilica. Yeah. That's a really breathtaking scene. So I think it's mostly man-made structures, because I remember climbing to the top of the Acrocorinth.
Yeah.
That really massive hill. We were up there.
Right.
That didn't cause me any anxiety. But somehow being on the top of a man-made structure seems to be more troubling.
Yeah.
How about you, Jeff?
Well,
what are some of yours?
You mentioned, you know, climbing to the top of St. Peter's. That combines kind of two of my rather pedestrian fears, acrophobia. I've never liked being on top of tall things. And then going up, some claustrophobia.
Oh, yeah.
You notice how that kind of labyrinth gets tighter and tighter as you get closer to the dome, top of the dome. I don't like that either.
Plus, there's sore calfophobia, right, after you've climbed all that way.
Lots of, yes, exactly.
You get to combine all three. What about some of the other phobias that are difficult to pronounce, yet mildly entertaining? Can you share some of those with us?
Yes, all Greek-based. So we have katagelophobia.
Yes.
That's a fear of literally kind of bad laughter.
Yes.
Fear of being ridiculed.
Yeah, fear of being laughed down, katagelaoed,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes, exactly.
Which is why we've had no guest hosts on Ad Nauseam yet, right?
That's right, exactly right. Well, we also have coulrophobia, the fear of clowns.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, this one has never made sense to me.
Really? Oh, I feel that one.
How could you be afraid of clowns?
Have you ever read or seen It?
No.
Okay, well,
I know it's a Stephen King impersonal pronoun entitled novel, but
yes.
I haven't read it.
It's like the same, like fear of ventriloquist dummies. It's kind of a classic horror trope. The fact that they look human, but they're not quite human. It's that uncanny liminal space that I think is horrifying.
Fear of clowns. The next one speaks to me more.
Ephebophobia.
Ephebophobia, yes. The fear of teenagers.
Yes. Absolutely.
You're not quite to that stage. You're getting pretty close.
I have one just teenager.
Okay.
But I find this when my wife, who teaches high school, when she asks me to give a guest talk, it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's much more terrifying than going into a college classroom.
Oh, yes, because teenagers are, they're potent in their sarcasm,
yes.
Right?
Oh, exactly. Cutting, unpredictable.
They see right through you.
They do.
How about cumpunophobia?
Oh, fear of buttons.
Yeah.
Right. I don't quite get that one myself, but I thought back. Do you remember the buttonfly jeans?
Yes,
back in
vaguely.
The 90s? Did you ever have a pair?
No, but see, I always go with the crow.
Go with the crow? What does that even mean?
Velcro. I always use Velcro. That's my slogan. Go with the crow. Okay. Skip buttons altogether.
I see. All right. We've got teratophobia, fear of ferns.
Fear of ferns.
It's very specific. I thought that was interesting. Why that particular plant?
I don't know.
Yes?
It doesn't make sense to me. You can't be fronds with a fern, maybe.
thalassophobia.
Fear of the open seas.
Yes. Now that one I get.
See, I don't. I would love to take one of those world tours, the Magellan Special.
Yeah.
Right? You get on a boat and sail all the way around the QE2.
Okay.
I'm not afraid of the open sea.
At the QE2, you're kind of... You're not really on the sea. You're on a giant RV.
I suppose there are times when you couldn't even visualize the sea from the poop deck.
Right, exactly. But like on a tiny raft with no land in sight, with all those creatures below, that gets the hair standing up in the back of my head.
And what if you are beset with endless crackers or saltines? What might you have?
You would have arachibutyrophobia.
Fear of peanut butter?
Fear of peanut butter, right. Now, that one I don't get at all.
No, I don't either.
Yes.
The Noe household consumes a lot of peanut butter.
As does the Winkle
household.
So, Jeff,
if you're listening, that's a potential sponsorship right there.
There you go. Right.
And the last one?
Alectorophobia. Yes. Fear of chickens.
Fear of chickens.
Right. I like to eat chicken, but I find chickens as an animal a little creepy.
Well, I've spent a fair amount of time around chickens, and in the barnyard hierarchy, they are right at the bottom.
Are they?
There's almost nothing more stupid than a chicken. So it's difficult for me to be afraid of something that's that idiotic.
I gotcha. We got to get down to the themes here. So what phobia are we talking about today?
So today, Jeff, we're talking about kenophobia, or horror vacui. Kenophobia, fear of empty places, empty space. The horror vacui, same thing, but a Latin title. So this is the fear of the empty or abandoned room, the fear of a basement where there's a lot of open space. And I think the idea is that, I'm no psychologist, but if you don't know what's in the space, there could be something menacing.
Right.
Something threatening.
Yeah. It's that whole, I use that kind of language of liminality. It's that...
You better define that term, because you use it so often.
Right, kind of the undefined in-between. I'm hoping we can do an episode on that. It's something that fascinates me, that the societies, cultures around the world from antiquity to today have this expression of the fear of the in-between, the threshold stuff. You know, the Greeks and Romans were very much in tune with that. So this reminds me of that. The emptiness is it's unbounded.
Okay.
And that's what makes it dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Spiritually speaking, psychologically speaking.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, this is a little different than another important concept that we will talk about in a future episode, the locus amoenus.
Yeah.
So the locus amoenus is the setting that's too perfect to be trusted.
Oh,
you walk into the idyllic meadow.
It's almost too ordered.
Correct.
Yeah.
So this is a similar idea, but it ought to be distinguished. I don't think there are any combinations of them, the too ordered yet empty place, but they're often confused, these two concepts, I would say.
Yeah. So, I mean, so in this episode, we're going to be looking mostly, as we get towards the kind of the our this vase we're talking about, horror vacui as an artistic principle. And so I don't know how much of a digression this is to talk about as kind of a psychological principle. I'm fascinated by the idea that those two go together.
Well, later on, when we talk about the Dipolan vase, we're going to look at one important scholar's comment on what might be driving this particular artistic expression.
Yeah.
So we will touch on that.
We'll touch on that, but we'll save it for now. Yeah. Now, in just some of the little bit of reading I did on this, I found that Aristotle may have had something to say about this, or we can look to Aristotle as maybe as an origin for this idea.
For sure. It's in Book 4 of his Physics, chapters 6 through 9. He's examining the question about whether a physical vacuum is possible. Specifically, Aristotle is interacting with the thought of Democritus of Abdera, a philosopher who lived just before him. Democritus was an atomist. He believed everything was atoms and the void, atoms falling through empty space. And so Aristotle takes issue with that and says, really, a physical vacuum is impossible.
Hmm.
So why this is interesting is because in this episode, we're not looking at the psychological concept of fear of empty space so much, nor the physical concept, but the artistic expression.
That's right. So before we get to our Greek examples, I thought it'd be interesting and useful to talk about other examples of the kind of horror vacui, where we see it in art. So if you do a little bit of internet digging under that phrase, you'll see things that pop up like the Where's Waldo books. I'm sure most listeners have seen those, you know, the comic pages with just the hundreds of characters, the art of Edward Gorey, Egyptian hieroglyphs, you know, filling the entire space of the tomb walls, Islamic art, kind of geometric design, calligraphy filling every square inch of the mosques. Underground comic art in the 1960s is often used as an example for the horror vacui. This is part of you know, Greek art is part of a long continuum of this. And I mean, I'm really fascinated by the, you know, this idea of artistic expression not simply just being the domain of the individual artist, but also reflecting maybe even subconsciously what's going on in the culture. And
you're in a little psychological there, Winkle.
I know this is not your kind of thing, right? Yeah, you're raising eyebrows at me. But this idea that the complexity, the wildness of art might be a reflection of kind of the wildness of the culture or kind of the upheaval of culture. I think there might be something there.
Okay.
We can come back to that.
So what are some counterexamples to this notion that more is more when it comes to artistic expression?
Right, yeah. So one of my favorite contemporary artists, or at least artists of the last 100 years, is Edward Hopper.
Mm-hmm.
Probably his most famous painting is his Nighthawks.
Yes, I love that.
That's a great. It's in the Art Institute of Chicago.
They're sitting in a diner, right?
Right. They're just kind of a few people gathered around the bar, and there's an empty, darkened street outside. It's a very lonely painting, as are most of his stuff. You have, you know, kind of an isolated house. You have an isolated sailboat, and so it's the opposite of like the Dipolan vase.
Right.
Hopper deliberately leaves lots of that empty space for an effect. In that, I mean, those paintings have the effect on me as kind of haunting, intriguingly so.
To menace or threaten.
Yes.
In a sense, or at least to suggest to the viewer something's wrong.
Something is wrong, right. It's hard to kind of really exactly put your finger on it, but there's something haunting, and it gives you an empty feeling that matches the emptiness of the space.
So you want to talk about The House by the Railroad, Hopper's 1925 painting?
Right. So to connect this to horror films, I don't believe this is completely nailed down, but there's a suggestion that that painting was the inspiration for the famous Psycho House that sits up on the hill above the Bates Motel in Hitchcock's 1960 film. But I really hope that's the case, because I think that, you know, Hitchcock knew his art very well, and Hitchcock recognizing there's something kind of unsettling about that house and say, I want that in my film, I think kind of ties these things together quite well. I'll defer to Hitchcock any day on the subject of horror.
What does the house look like? And we're going to put this in the show notes, right? So that viewers can go look at the house and have a moment of architectural revulsion.
Exactly right. So it's kind of a tall, Gothic-looking house. Many kind of long rectangular windows, a rectangular porch jutting out the front of it.
This would not appeal to Hawthorne, right?
No.
Not enough gables?
No, I don't see one gable on this thing. Right. A house of no gables. But yeah, if you're familiar with the imagery of Hitchcock's Psycho, you'll see this and you'll immediately recognize the house here. All right, so let's get down to our Greek examples. So, but before we get to the physical pottery, works of art, let's talk a bit about the time period. When are we talking about? What's going on? Because I think that's essential for understanding these vases.
So the background here is late geometric, early archaic period. So since the fall of Troy, we can say 1235, 1183, 1235, the archaeological date, 1183, the historical date given by the ancients. From there down to about this time period, 750, Greece is going through what has traditionally been called a dark age.
Archaeologically speaking, it's a period of silence. There's not much going on.
Yes.
Cities are being abandoned more than they're being built.
It's a lull, right? So there are no longer exotic foreign objects in burials. There seems to have been a great decline in literacy. There's a massive decline in population, as judged by the material remains, disappearance of luxury arts and writing. There's no more monumental architecture. People are not building giant temples or palaces, things like that. In terms of metallurgy, which of course is fascinating for everyone, at this point, bronze is replaced with iron technology. We have the migration, potentially, this is hotly disputed, but the migration of a new subculture, the Dorians, into Greece. Now, the Dorians were the ancestors of the Spartans, and there is a Doric dialect. But the main point here is that in this time of great flux, there were migrations, decline in population, decline in wealth. And right near the end of this period, around the middle of the 8th century, around 750, we start to see an uptick in the fortunes of Greece.
Right. So it's some would point to this moment as kind of where Greek culture, ancient Greek culture, as we tend to recognize it, really begins.
Yes, it emerges here. After going underground, you might say, after the fall of the Mycenaeans. So this is right around the time of Homer. Homer could be 825, 750 maybe. Hesiod for sure, 750, 700. And in terms of art, we are right at the end of the geometric period. So art historians, they divide this up into proto-geometric, geometric, late geometric. And the geometric period then, in the artistic sphere, what kinds of things, Jeff, are happening on the pottery in particular? What do we see?
As the name of the era gives it away, the simple geometric designs, spirals and circles. We're seeing pottery emerging, used for kind of practical day-to-day use, drinking, but starting also to find kind of ritual pottery used in funerary contexts. We're seeing some early stabs at depicting nature, animals, kind of human beings depicted on these vases comes later in these periods. But we're starting to see a building complexity of design, a growing quality of the vases themselves. The Greeks are figuring things out.
That's really interesting, Jeff. So I want to describe for the listener a proto-geometric amphora. Now, the amphora is the most common type of ancient jar.
Right.
It was the, I like to compare it to the water bottle of antiquity. So these water bottles that contain Evian and so forth, these are pretty much ubiquitous now in our society. You can find them everywhere.
Right. In ancient Greece, these are, in any kind of pottery display in any museum, will have multiple examples of this kind of.
That's right.
From the tiny to the huge.
Right. Some of them are almost 2 meters in height. Some of them, like you said, are tiny, down to about the size of your hand. They traveled all over the Mediterranean. They were cheap, easy to make. Most of them were not decorated. It's the decorated ones that interest us most, the ones that have been painted. So a proto-geometric amphora, this is in Athens from about 950. So this is the beginning, right? Proto-geometric, the beginning of the geometric era, has simple design. We'll put this up in the show notes. Lots of space. There are no human forms on the vase at all, on the amphora. There are some zoomorphic forms, that is, shapes of horses. But here we do not see the horror vacui. We see instead lots of vacui.
Right. So if Edward Hopper were an ancient Greek potter, this would be right up his alley.
Right. He would love this.
Right.
All empty space, virtually.
Right. So but, I think that goes kind of against this theory of the art reflecting the time. If a simpler, kind of more contained, more empty space is reflective of a more settled culture, a more confident culture, here coming this example from about 950. This is not a settled time in ancient Greece at all, right?
No, it's still a time of great turmoil.
Right.
Our next example is the one you're going to share with us, right?
That's right. So we move to what's often called the earlier middle geometric period. So we're in terms of chronology, we're talking about 900 to 750 BC. And the example that we've chosen, again, you can see this in the show notes, is a terracotta pyxis, kind of a small round pot. It has kind of a tall, kind of spiral-shaped kind of handle on the top.
On a lid,
on
right?
On a lid, yes. You can remove this and use this for, you know, storing whatever you want to store.
Cosmetics often, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah, the pyxis is often synonymous with that.
You put a little bit of olive oil in there. You add in some rose petals or lavender or something like that.
Right.
And then you just dab a little bit of it on your cheek.
A little spritz, you're ready to go.
I'm sure you do this often, Jeff.
Well, my house is filled with these pixies.
The vomitorium is redolent.
It is.
Oh, with the smell of lavender.
Suffocatingly so. Right. So if you look at this in the show notes and you compare it to the amphora that Dave was just talking about, you notice that the design is much more complex, mm-hmm. or at least the space on the pot is much more filled. You have that famous kind of wave-like meander,
mm-hmm.
Which is...
What is that? That's the Greek key?
The Greek key, as it's sometimes called, right?
Okay.
Some people think it's supposed to represent the waves of the sea.
I've heard it's supposed to represent eternal life.
Eternal life.
It has no beginning or end point.
Ah, okay. You see what you want to see mm-hmm. in the Greek key. But here you see an early example of that. And then on the lid and on the handle, you know, every band is filled with paint. So we're getting towards that horovakoi filling every space, which is the hallmark of the big Dipolon vase, which we're getting down to.
All right, Jeff, but before we get to that, we need to hear from our sponsors.
We do.
And the listener wants to stay tuned because after this little segment here of sponsorship, we have a juicy clip which will forever and definitively answer the question, can you spare a square?
This episode of Ad Nauseam is brought to you by Hackett Publishing. Hackett has been putting out affordable, accessible, visually attractive translations of literature representing everything under the wide umbrella of the humanities for nearly 50 years.
Both Jeff and I have used Hackett's translations in our classes and for pleasure reading. Whatever you are looking for, tragedy, comedy, history, philosophy, poetry, Hackett has a volume that will appeal to seasoned scholars and novices alike.
But that's not the best part.
I know, I was getting to that, Jeff.
Yeah, I got it. The best part is that from now until December 31st, Ad Nauseam listeners can save 20% and receive free shipping on any purchase. 20% off, free shipping. Dave, tell them how to do it.
You're awfully bossy today, Wink.
I know.
My pleasure. Listeners, to get this great deal, all you have to do is go to Hackett Publishing, H-A-C-K-E-T-T, HackettPublishing.com, find the text you want, throw them in your digital shopping cart, and enter the code AN2020 in the box, which asks for the coupon code.
That's HackettPublishing.com, coupon code AN2020. Check it out today. Are you a coffee drinker, Dave?
Oh, you know it. If you cut me, do I not bleed coffee?
I know you do. How do you get your daily cup of delight, the sort of brew that sustains you while you wade through exams and quizzes, preparing intricate and soul-breaking assignments for your poor students?
Well, Jeff, every morning I brew a pot of fine Java with a Ratio 8, an automatic pour-over coffee maker.
Oh, I've seen that machine, and I know you really love it. So tell us what you like about it, Dave.
Well, first of all, it is beautiful. It's not something to be ashamed of when it sits on your countertop. Some people use an appliance hutch, but you want to take this out and show it to your guests.
And I understand it brews fine coffee, yes?
You got that right. Ratio coffee makers are made of all premium quality materials. Aluminum and stainless steel, high quality borosilicate glass, no plastic or other junk, and a heating element that goes from 0 to 200 degrees Fahrenheit in under 20 seconds.
Whoosh.
It comes with a 5-year warranty, Jeff. What kind of a coffee maker gives you that? Can you tell our listeners about the great discount they're going to receive?
I can. Ratio is offering 15% off their Ratio 6. It's featured at places like Crate and Barrel and Williams-Sonoma. But Ad Nauseam listeners can get a direct-to-consumer discount by going to ratiocoffee.com and entering our special code ANCO, ANCO. And they will get 15% off the Ratio 6 between now and March 20, 2021. So go to ratiocoffee.com, enter the special code ANCO, A-N-C-O, for 15% off the Ratio 6.
Now, that's a great bargain, Jeff.
Excuse me. I'm sorry. This is kind of embarrassing, but there's no toilet paper over here. Are you talking to me? Yeah, I just forgot to check. So if you could spare some. No, I'm sorry. What? No, I'm sorry, I can't spare it. You can't spare it? No, there's not enough to spare. Well, I don't need much. Just three squares will do it. I'm sorry, I don't have three squares. Now, if you don't mind. Three squares? You can't spare three squares? No, I don't have a square to spare. I can't spare a square. Well, is it too fine?
Well, it's going to be hard to top that clip, isn't it, Jeff?
Indeed. I can't spare a square.
No, you're quite the Seinfelder, aren't you?
I consider myself to be fairly versed.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many times have you watched each episode?
I'd probably say at least five each.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. Are you up there, too?
Three and a half, probably.
Yeah, you can drop a quote.
I can, yeah. When I need to.
That's right.
So what are some of the hallmarks of late geometric art? Because we're past the proto, the middle, we're getting right down to 750 and the big tamale, right? I use tamale pretty often, don't I, on this episode?
Or enchilada.
Yeah, okay, the big enchilada, the
Dibelon vase, right. So what's going on here is we have, again, increasing complexity in design and art. The quality of the pottery is getting better. The painting techniques, we don't have time to get into all of that, but the way that the Greeks colored their pots is incredibly complex.
The technology is advancing.
It's advancing. The use of high-temperature kilns. And in terms of artistic design, we're seeing a lot more depictions of animals. And finally, the human form becoming much more regular on these vases.
Yeah, we're on our way to one of my favorites, actually, the Chigi vase.
Oh, yeah, the Chigi vase.
Which is found in Italy. And it's a beautiful tableau of different aspects of a Greek man's life told in three panels on the vase. But unfortunately, today is the Dipolon vase instead.
We'll get chiggy with it.
We will get chiggy later on.
Another time, right.
So like you said, increasing quality and consistency of the pottery. Most of these pots were put together. They were manufactured, as I understand, in stages. So they were turned on a wheel, would have been run by a foot pedal or something like that.
Yeah.
To get the revolutions up. And turned in segments and then joined together and smoothed over. So you couldn't really tell, unless you examined them very closely, that they were originally separate parts before being assembled.
Yeah, it's incredible. The Dipolon, it's seamless. I've looked at it very closely. Mm-hmm. I can't notice any. It looks like it was turned in one sitting.
But it's enormous.
It's enormous.
1.5 meters, right?
Right. Many,
so it's
many pieces
close
put together.
To 6 feet
yeah,
in height.
Huge. Yeah.
It's massive. And it's right there in the archaic art room in the National Museum in Athens.
Mm-hmm.
You go past the Mask of Agamemnon, you go back around this one corner. I know I'm being very specific in my description here. I can see it in my mind's eye. And there, the Dipolon vase confronts you.
Very impressive.
It's really, really glorious.
So, Dave, you were talking about the kind of the technology behind making these vases. I wonder if you could give us a little bit more about, you know, how these vases were made and what they looked like.
Right. So there's a river going through Athens, the Kerameikos River. And keramos is the Greek word for clay. Now, I'm not an expert in this, but different qualities of clay have very different compositions. You want a clay that's very uniform, doesn't have any foreign particles in it. So what the Greeks would do is they would dig this clay out of the banks of the river in the Kerameikos area of Athens. It's a neighborhood now. And they would dig this clay out and they put it in big vats of water and they would let the particles settle out. And this was a purification process. So then when they had this very pure clay, they'd turn it on the wheel in segments, they'd fire it in a kiln, and then they would glaze it. They'd paint it, and then it would be fired again. Oftentimes, the potter and the painter were different persons. So if you were a painter, you'd go to the potter's shop and you'd select a vase that was half finished. You would then paint it, and it would be kiln fired, and then you'd sell it to your patron. So the Dipolon vase is from the area near the Dipolon Gate.
The double gate, this massive gate that was one of the entrances to the ancient city of Athens.
That's right. Dipolon means double gate. So last week, or a couple weeks ago, we accessed a pylon, remember? And we went back to Hesiod.
That's right.
So pylon is a gate, and a lot of these objects, including this famous vase, were found near this important gate, which is in the Kerameikos region.
Right, which is archaeologically and culturally famous for being a cemetery, a funerary
yes.
region, right?
Correct. And this vase, like many of the ancient works of art, was used in a funeral.
Right.
So if you were a wealthy individual, like everyone, you wanted to mark the passing of your loved one. Now, the wealthy individual had a lot more means at his disposal to do so. So when your wife died, as the character on the Dipolon vase, you would go to the potter and you'd say, I want this particular amphora, make it 1.5 meters high, and I'm going to get it painted in this particular way. So then the artist would get a commission to produce this funerary vase, which you would then place next to the grave of your beloved forever to memorialize her. So Jeff, now that we've described a little bit the process of composition, what do we see on the Dipolon vase itself?
So on this massive vase, we see the meander shows up a number of times. We have parallel lines circling the vase in on the kind of the high stem and in kind of the fat, rounded belly of the pot. Speaking of Horovakui, again, every single spot on this vase is filled with something. But we have kind of towards the top, there's a band that shows what some people think are, you know, horses or goats. It's hard to say. You know, the figures of the animals are very geometric themselves. But it's most famous for this central band that runs around near kind of, we might call, the equator of the pot. It kind of lines up with the two big handles on either side.
Yeah, the kind of the belly, the part that flares out.
Yeah.
Right below the handles.
Right. You were just talking about it, these being funerary markers. And the most famous artistic thing about the vase is this funerary scene that's right in the middle. What's called the prothesis,
right.
I believe, right? So we have a quote here that kind of unpacks that a little bit from Mark Stansbury O'Donnell, where he writes, "The prothesis at the funerary rite in which the body of the deceased is laid on a bier and prepared for burial. The body is usually flanked by mourners," and that's exactly what we see here.
Mm. So Jeff, in this presentation, this tableau of the prothesis itself, the carrying out of the dead, there is a woman reclining right in the middle on this bier. She's the deceased. Below her are four figures, two of them seated, two of them kneeling, and they have their arms raised. They're highly geometrical figures themselves, almost like Dorito chips.
They do look like Dorito chips.
Very awkwardly presented. And I like to explain to my students that we shouldn't assume this was the level of skill of the artist. It's not as though ancient people couldn't draw as well. It's that perhaps they're after something other than strict representationalism.
Right. So now we're getting into kind of a more interpretation of it rather than descriptive, right?
Yes. And so then off to the left and the right of the bier, there are a number of figures. There are six, it looks like, on the right, and an equal number, symmetrical, six on the left. This is not probably the total number of individuals at the burial, but rather it's meant to show the fullness of the turnout for this poor woman in her death. So she's laying on the bier. Above her is a checkered cloth, but the cloth is raised so that you can see the body, and some of the proportions and the angles are not realistic as to what it would be if you witnessed this with the eye.
No.
So some of it is probably limited by the artist's talent, but most of it is, I would say, because they were trying to emphasize certain things.
Right. It's what I find so striking is, so if you see these mourners here with their arms kind of continue the triangle shape of their body.
Correct.
And I think you could tell, I mean, if you isolated a figure, you can tell that they're upset. Right?
Absolutely. Like they're tearing their hair.
Tearing their hair out, right. And the woman on the bier, too, as I understand it, we think it's a woman because she appears to be wearing a dress.
Correct.
Right? And that's I don't think there's anything more than that.
No,
right?
But generally speaking, the male and female figures are not easily distinguishable at this time in Greek history.
Right.
So on vase painting.
Right. So, if you look at the mourners that are right underneath the bier, you can see the two figures on the left seem to be female.
Right.
And then the two seated figures, male.
Right.
Just by kind of what they're wearing or what they're not wearing. Dave, do we know anything about who might have painted this?
Well, the man is called the Dipolon Master. And this is actually what the Germans call a Notname. That is a placeholder kind of name. So it describes a person who is artistically famous, but their precise identity is unknown.
Now, that's interesting. We know what's from a lot of later Greek vases, we have artists signing their work. And
right.
We know some names, but we're not there yet.
No. So the famous Exequias,
yes.
For example, in the middle 500s, Exequias painted Achilles and Penthesilea, a very beautiful vase. Which
it's one of my absolute favorites.
Yeah, it's at the top of my list. It's in the British Museum. He signed it with his name, Exequias.
Right. And he often would sign it, even it says, Exequias made me.
That's right.
Right. Yeah, the pot
absolutely.
Is telling you.
Yeah, but that's 200 years later. So at this point, we can tell that the vase was painted by the same person, you know, that different vases were painted by the same person based on the brush strokes and the style and so forth. But this guy is just known as the Dipolon Master. So he hit his peak 760 to 750 BC, and it's a notname, like the Berlin painter, and one of my favorites. This is from the 15th century AD, the Master of the Drapery Studies.
Ooh. Sounds intimidating.
Meister der Gewandstudien. the master of the drapery studies. You should have a title like that, Jeff.
I should.
Have you been studying your draperies?
I have, but I haven't made any progress on my thesis.
You haven't gotten to the level of master?
My draperies at my house are a mess.
Yeah. So no MDS for you.
not anywhere close.
So, Jeff, we've described a little bit of what's on the vase and a little bit of the painter. What about some of the composition? Do we know anything about that?
Well, let's turn to, again, to Stansbury O'Donnell quote here, which will unpack some of these things.
This work was, sorry to interrupt, this was 2015?
2015, yes.
Okay.
Yes, A History of Greek Art.
Okay. Yep.
And he writes, "These monumental vases created external visual markers of elite status that continued to be seen long after the funeral. The Dipolon amphora was made in three sections and joined, and its proportions are carefully controlled. The neck is half the height of the body, creating a 1-to-2 proportion, and the base's widest diameter is in the same proportion to its height, 1-to-2. The ornamental bands have now taken over the entire surface of the vase, with a single, double, and triple meanders arranged in a varied and rhythmic pattern that frames the central figure seen placed between the handles."
Now, Jeff, the Dipolon master painted some other vases whereby he got his name.
Right. So we find them, I mean, there's other examples in Athens. I believe there's at least one in New York at the
New York City?
New York City, the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Have you been to the Metropolitan?
I have not.
How about the Guggenheim?
I am not much of a Guggenheimer.
Not much of a Guggenheimer?
No.
So there's a third one, which is in the British Museum, also dated to about 750.
Yeah.
And of course, it's called, I have seen this one, of course, it's called the Elgin Amphora. Thanks to Lord Elgin.
Lord Elgin, yeah.
It's there. I think it's on the same floor. I can't remember for sure. I can, again, see it in my mind's eye. The same floor as the famous Exequias, Achilles and Penthesilea.
Their vase collection there, it's intimidating.
It is.
It's massive.
It's Horovakovi,
it
right?
Is Horovakovi, exactly
the
right.
The British Museum is so stuffed. There's not a square to spare, you might say.
Right. As someone who suffers from attention deficit disorder, it's like walking into a carpet store with all the samples and trying to decide on which
master
one you're
going to... Master of drapery studies.
Exactly, right, right.
So Jeff, as we coast to our conclusion here, let's bring it back around to Horovakovi. What does the Dipolon vase teach us, if anything, about how the Greeks were thinking at the time?
You're suggesting this might mean something?
Well, it's possible.
It's possible, right. So, you know, is it just kind of an artistic motif? Is it an artist showing off and showing how much that he can do with every little space? Or is it reflective of something else? I mean, I'm really attracted to this idea that, you know, that the time in which this vase was made was a time of transition. We're moving from tyranny, from kings, down towards something like Athenian democracy in a couple of centuries. Could this kind of complexity of the vase reflect a kind of a complexity of the society that it's reflective of that.
Yeah. So yeah. We have a few more ages of tyranny to go through.
We do. It's not around the corner.
You're right. 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 So 590 is Solon. Then we got the Pisistratids still, but definitely the time of turmoil.
Yeah. Eras of turmoil often give rise to artistic innovation, right? So this reminds me of like the 1960s, an era of kind of political turmoil. You have this explosion in
pop
modern
music,
art.
Poetry. Music.
Yes, exactly right. So could this have been an era like that?
It's hard to know what's the cause and what's the effect.
Of course, right. And a lot of this is of course, subjective.
Right.
Yep.
But our interpretation is correct.
Well, of course. Doesn't that just go without saying? All right, so let's turn to someone who might actually know something about these
That's
things.
That's a good idea.
I believe you have a quote from John Boardman.
Sir John Boardman.
Sir John Boardman. I had no idea.
Yeah, not Bon Jovi. Sir John Boardman. This is from Greek Art. This is the fifth edition, published by Thames and Hudson, 2016. He says, quote, "While in the proto-geometric period, the artist confined his decoration to clearly defined areas of the vase, the geometric painter soon let friezes of zigzags and meanders cover the whole vessel, filling in the blank spaces of the earlier vases with strips of simple pattern." I love this quote here. "The overall effect is fussy but precise." That's how I'm often described. "And the shape is still well enough expressed by setting the emphatic patterns at the neck, shoulder, or between the handles. But it looks as though the artist was more intent on the patterns themselves and the variants upon them to the detriment of the general effect of the vase as an expression of the wedded crafts of potter and painter. The zones are broken into panels with individual motifs of circles, swastikas, or diamonds, and the resultant checkered appearance as a depressingly rhythmic and mechanical effect."
So he ultimately doesn't like it.
I don't think so. Or at least he finds the obsession with filling every nook and cranny to be distracting.
Yeah.
Depressingly mechanical.
Almost like a Jackson Pollock.
Yes.
A more organized Jackson Pollock.
Did you just compare Jackson Pollock to the Dipolon vase?
I did. And I stand by it.
Okay. So what are your walls like at home in Shea Winkle?
Oh, I'm chucking paint at them every weekend. Yeah.
But do you have paintings and how are they hung?
I do have some paintings. Okay. Yes. Right. How are they hung? They're on the wall.
Well,
with a
okay.
Nail, right.
Yeah. No, you know what I'm saying. Do you fill every nook and cranny from baseboard to crown molding? Is it all filled with art?
Of course not. It's more kind of a less is more philosophy in our house, right? It's that dizzying effect. I mean, I think I'm with Boardman here. I mean, I admire the Dipolon vase and I admire the painting, but it's not, you know, an art style that I'm drawn to. I never liked those Where's Waldo books. My boys liked them, and I never wanted to find that guy.
No, let him find himself.
He can find himself.
Go find yourself, Waldo.
Right. But it's the carpet store all over again. Mm. It just gives me a headache looking at that. Now, with a Dipolon painter, I find it fascinating as kind of an artifact of the time.
Yes.
How does it tell us what's going on in the culture?
Historically interesting.
Right. I wouldn't want this, you know, on my table. Or, you know, with a plant sticking out of it mm-hmm. in my house. It's too much. So I think I'm with Boardman here, basically, in kind of the depressingly rhythmic and mechanical effect.
Do you like to watch those shows on hoarding? Do you ever watch those shows about the hoarders?
My wife loves those, right.
Is this because she tends toward hoarding, or she likes to look at the hoarding that others do and, you know, remain above the fray, above the hoard?
She would never admit to that. She's more
careful here with
you. No, because she doesn't listen to
this. She doesn't listen to the podcast.
I know. Can you believe it? Yeah. She's more interested in kind of the psychology of it. You know, what would drive somebody to do that? Right.
Right.
But, yeah.
Depressingly mechanical.
Right. So I wonder if the Dipolon painter, what his house was like.
If he was a hoarder.
If he was a hoarder.
There's a good chance.
That's possible. So we got to get out of here. We got to wrap this up. So before we do, what struck you this week? I mean, what were you drawn to? This is not our field of expertise. But
no.
In looking over this and kind of doing some research, I mean, what struck you as being interesting and important?
Right. So, you know, as a listener knows, I've said it before, I'm trained as a philologist, lover of words, a little bit of a button phobe, and also got some philosophical and theological training. In recent years, I've taught art and architecture by necessity. So I've learned to love these objects, and I am overwhelmed when I meet them in person. So I was really eager to cover this episode on the Dipolon vase because it is such a beautiful and impressive object. But what stood out to me in our discussion is the attempt to gauge the mindset of the painter or of the culture based on the works of art that it produces. I really liked the comparison to Hopper that you came up with. I like Hopper's Nighthawk painting and The Lonely House by the Railroad. So thinking about that in terms of the Dipolon vase painter, these individuals are separated by, 2,700 years, mm-hmm. give or take? And yet we see a great continuity in human expression. Same sorts of fears and obsessions beset us all at all times.
Oh, I like that.
Make it a little philosophical.
Yeah, so, I mean, I love that kind of the idea that humanity has no history. That there's kind of this direct line. We shouldn't treat the ancient Greeks as kind of an alien species is what I'm saying.
Humanity has no history, you mean? Flesh that out for me a little bit.
Just like you were saying, we see ourselves in them. We see that in some ways, you know, nothing has changed. We're still dealing with the same stuff in different ways. We're still seeing these same kind of anxieties reflected in art and in our culture.
Okay.
That help us to kind of, again, draw these lines, you know, thousands of years back and connect us to these people.
Right. So at your tomb, right, when that day comes.
Yeah.
And we record our last podcast, right?
Right.
What's going to be placed at your grave?
I want an Exequias pot.
You do?
Yeah. This episode has made me think about wanting to do an episode on kind of the history of pottery and the art that kind of follows on the heels
of
this.
But, so we can think about future episodes, Jeff, but specifically what's going to be at your tomb is what I'm saying.
I'm pot painted by Exequias.
Oh, well, that's going to be difficult.
I'm going to filch it from the British Museum.
And, Ocean's 14.
There you go.
What's going to be involved to get that item.
There you go. I'd watch that movie. So, Dave, what do you want at your tomb?
Maybe a stack of books.
Ah.
So I have the inscription worked out already. There's going to be something in Greek, something in Latin, maybe a little bit of Hebrew, but then just a pile of books so I can finally catch up on my reading.
Sounds good. You'll have plenty of time.
Speaking of time, loyal listener, we'd like you to please subscribe on our Podbean site.
Please.
That hosts this podcast. Leave reviews, if you don't mind, at Spotify and iTunes and Google Podcast, all those places. If you like what you hear, Please patronize our sponsors. Also send feedback in the form of an email to jeff@adnauseum.com. That's with a V. We've gotten some great feedback this week. Or where else can they send praise and accolades?
To dave@adnauseum.com.
We also accept criticisms, don't we?
We do, yes.
Reluctantly.
Petulantly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Jeff, what are we looking at next week?
Next week is going to be part one of a two-parter. We're going to do some Greek tragedy.
All right,
Euripides' Alcestis, which is I was thinking about it today. I think it might be my favorite Greek tragedy. Yes.
This is the woman that goes to the underworld.
She does
in place of her husband.
Right.
Spoiler alert.
That's exactly right. But it's going to be great. Part one of two.
All right. So we have some people to thank, don't we?
We do.
We want to thank our trenchant sound engineer, Mishka Fernando, who
always
puts us all together so nicely. We want to thank the musicians that give us the intro and outro music. And Jeff, you have the gastroclassical parting shot this week, don't you?
I do. And this week it comes to us from Irma Bombeck, who wrote, "Seize the moment. Remember all those women on the Titanic who waved off the dessert cart."
That's great. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.